my own physicality, I like to imagine that the reason I have the capacity and the capabilities that I have is due to great sacrifice and pain. Mm-hmm. But no, a lot of the things that I do have been given to me mm-hmm. by others, the inspiration mm-hmm. and the belief and the motivation I get from them, from my environment, you know, growing up next to the woods and also getting to investigate two cultures, being half and half, mm-hmm. and my genetics as well. You know, some things are simply given, and I think, although it is tempting to say this is due to my personal sacrifice, I think the greatest thing we can do for these gifts and for others is to be honest about where they're from.
Welcome to the Talking, Teaching and Flow podcast. My name is Rafan Kebe, and this is a podcast about the art and artistry of teaching and of coaching others to find their flow. Today, my guest is John Yuen. Such an amazingly humble person. He's a coach and a trainer based in Norway. Someone that I've been following for a few years now, as I've seen pictures and, more importantly, videos of him traveling through space and going through some of his workouts. And I've been impressed by what I could recognize as the ability to really focus, concentrate, and give his all to both his training and his coaching. It is something to me that was so apparent that I've been wanting to have a chat with him for a very, very long time. So very, very pleased to have him on the podcast. You will discover how humble this young man is and how knowledgeable as well he is. I've had a very good time reading through his blog, watching some of his videos in preparation for this conversation. And I do invite you to go and read his words, his thoughts, and his philosophy on life and on training. And I have with me today the magnificent, as far as I could tell, watching his videos and reading his blog, Mr. John Yuen. John, have I said your name correctly?
Yeah, John Yuen. Well, my this is the anglified version of my name. My real name is Jon Henrik Eikli Yuen, but I'm not going to put people through that. So John Yuen is perfectly fine.
Awesome. So John Yuen, thank you so very, very much for being on the Talking, Teaching and Flow podcast. It's such an honor.
Thanks for inviting me.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure. So listen, I've got a few things that I'd love for us to talk about, namely movement, coaching, the stuff that both you and I are somewhat known for. And with that in mind, I thought we'd start with the end. And you know what I mean? Or what I think is the end when it comes to movement, when it comes to coaching and teaching, but also when it comes to life. All right. So like this, 7 or 8 years ago, my beloved Feldenkrais trainer in the name of Larry Goldfrapp said something. We were in Frankfurt. I haven't graduated at the time. I still haven't actually, but he let me on a postgraduate training. And during that conversation, during the day of training, he said something that just really stuck with me. He said, "The path to freedom is to be found within constraints, within limitations." My reaction was, fuck this. No. I'm French. So I went straight back into no. So I thought we could start with this. We're going to be talking about you, your past, your present, and the future, I'm sure. But why not delve straight into what I think might just be the end? Which is the path to freedom is to be found, within limitations. What does that make you feel or think about when you hear that?
I think limitations and restrictions are necessary, especially for beginners, the more limitations that are you have, the easier it is to create momentum that allows you to start a process. And I do sincerely believe that the nemesis of creativity is the absence of limitations. If you can do everything, if you have the opportunity to do whatever you would like, then you're probably going to end up doing very few things, or you're going to keep on doing the same thing that you've always done. Mm-hmm. So having some sort of limitation will either allow you to do something new, to think something new, to create something new. So I think it is helpful.
It is helpful, yeah. It is true. I find it necessary. I think you've been very, very kind when you say it's helpful. I find myself dealing in limitations more than anything else, interestingly enough, as both in my personal practice and in my teaching, in that what I offer, I found, is basically a set of limitations through which people are, as far as I can hope, can then discover their own potential. Mm-hmm. By the working it out of things, if that makes sense. No. Yeah,
I agree. I think it is, especially if you're a coach or an instructor, thinking about restrictions and limitations and focusing on that, I think is more helpful than focusing on instructions. It's like, it's better to talk about what not to do than what to do, in the sense that if I'm a movement teacher and I try to explain to you how to perform a specific movement, then the result is that you're going to end up being able to do that specific movement, or at least practice it. But if I instead give you just a set of limitations, then you are potentially giving them loads more options. Yeah. You're basically giving them instead of giving them a path, you give them a framework, and they're allowed to operate within that framework and figure out their own, come up with their own type of solutions. And by doing so, we're also promoting autonomy, which I think is the golden chalice of coaching.
Mm-hmm. True. Yeah, no, I hear you. And I'm laughing and smiling right now, because most of the conversations I have with teachers, and especially the teachers that I mentor, I find myself going back to this. I think my first job as a teacher is to teach you how to learn. What is it that I'm teaching? But the last job, and I'm count this as the third job, I'm only giving myself three, is to make myself obsolete. Is to really and truly give you the tools to empower yourself to not need me anymore. And I think that the term, you know, self-agency that you mentioned there is pretty much spot on, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's only so much a teacher can teach. Some lessons can only be learned, and by the individual going through the experience. So we need to know when to take a major step back, if not remove ourselves from the situation entirely.
Yeah. Reading through your blog, I came across an article where you shared that you lived in Shanghai for a year. And I picked up a quote on this as well, of what you decided to remember from your kung fu coach or sifu, that said, training is not just a problem to be solved. It is a series of moments to be experienced. Can you possibly expand on this for us?
Yeah. I guess the short and slightly less esoteric answer would be, you know, to be process oriented and not only goal oriented. Mm-hmm. So often training is designed based on the end result that we want, mm-hmm. which is important. It's important to, you know, make sure that you are working towards whatever you want to get from your program or your training or your movement. Yeah. But at the same time, it's very helpful to immerse oneself in the experience, because the result is one thing, but the lessons are another. Let's say learning a backflip, or the act of doing a backflip compared to when you didn't do it. And the act of lifting three times your body weight in a back squat compared to when you didn't do it, that doesn't necessarily give you a lot except for that specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the process of going towards that that's going to give you a lot of lessons that might actually allow you to guide yourself towards a more positive direction, more positive choices, more inspired choices, maybe.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, just allowing yourself to be immersed in the experience, in trying to savor all the moments, trying to see what kind of lessons there are, and also focusing on not only improvement. Also focusing on just the experience. Does this suck? If so, let it suck, you know? Be angry, be mad, be frustrated, and enjoy the human experience of actually getting to feel those emotions and the positive emotions as well.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, what I hope is that through my training is that I accumulate a series. Well, not a series, but a bunch of memories, you know? I want to have cool things to look back on and go like, oh, that was horrible, or that was fun. when I'm on my deathbed, speaking of the end, mm-hmm. when I'm on my deathbed, I want to have a lot of memories to look back on. And I want to feel like I was in the moment, or in the moments.
Yeah. That you were fully there as much as you possibly could. Wow. Awesome. I read this phrase on again, one of your articles. We become more competent at managing our experience the more involved we are in the experience. And competence creates confidence. And I really, really, really like that. I do think that not only it creates confidence, but it somehow gives us the gift of having that sense of purpose also, which may be a beautiful tool towards fighting depression, anxiety, and you name it, and all those various negative things that we may be going through in our lives. Can we talk about competence, especially when it comes to movement?
Yeah, we sure can. We can try. There are so many different definitions and so many different ideas. Probably as many, many definitions as there are individuals. I guess there are three main categories of competence.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's what comes to my mind right now. The first one would probably be like the functional understanding of what's going on, you know, and this is where what motivates a lot of people is the feeling that I know what this movement, what this exercise produces. I have learned what the intercostal muscles are. I know what glenohumeral circumduction is. I know the term hypertrophy. I now feel like I am more competent because I have this knowledge. And then there's the practical competence, which I'm a big fan of, which is feeling I know how to manage myself in my immediate environment. Mm-hmm. I know that I can fall safely. I know that I can get up from the floor. I know that I can traverse this wall. I know I can get over that hurdle. I know how I can circumnavigate that obstacle. The confidence based on the competence mm-hmm. of knowing that you can manage yourself. You can handle yourself in various situations. I like that because it's a very honest, you know, type of confidence. It isn't based on ideas that some or words that somebody else has designed for us and mm-hmm. concepts that somebody else has designed mm-hmm. for us. And the last type of competence would be personal. And that I'm not going to define that because that's up to the individual, you know. Mm-hmm. I feel competent just getting to sit here and talk to you. You know, being honored by being just asked to share my thoughts and opinions on a topic that makes me feel competent. Exactly how? I don't know, but it's personal.
Yeah.
And it feels good.
Yeah.
What about you? How do you relate to that word?
I relate to it from the first one that you mentioned. I'm sorry, the third one that you mentioned as the first one, actually, which might not be the healthiest way all the time, but I find that the validity that I find in myself and others liking what I or benefiting from what I do, a great source of competence or feeling. I'm competent, meaning that what I create is useful for others and I am being acknowledged by their presence or their willingness to talk with me. So for it to give you that compliment back, when you said yes to talking with me, I thought, you know what, this is someone I look up to in terms of what he seems to be able to not only do, but also express. And I feel competent by him saying, you know what, I'll chat with you. So we have that as well. The practical aspect of what some people may call skin in the game, so to speak, is perhaps to me the most important one as well. Especially nowadays in this beautiful world that we live in where social media is there and everyone is an expert. And to go to your point number one in terms of the understanding, people have got a massive vocabulary of things and they've got an array of diplomas on their walls and they've got, you know, many teachers to speak good things about there. We live in a world where a lot of people know a lot of theory. And whilst this is very useful, it's only useful up to a point. So skin in the game to me, where practice with a capital P is something that I really, really look up to. And, so I find myself attracted, but also inspired, by people who I feel I've got very high standards in that number two game, which is, you know, the skin in the game aspect of, yes, I want to be able to speak about those things, about the glenohumeral movement aspect, reading, pardon me, of my shoulder, or I want to be able to verbalize and have discussions with osteopaths and doctors and perhaps make myself understood by someone who's well-educated or someone who's not very well-educated. But at the same time, nothing beats the, you know what, I spent enough time walking with my spine and my belly to know what my intercostal feel like when I breathe in a certain way. And whether or not I know how to spell the name, I actually know how to tap into them. I know how to produce something out of my relationship with them. I think that is amazing. Interesting enough. Go for it. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say it's an interesting, I often think that bodily wisdom is something that we lose with time, as you know, when we go from being a kid or let's use the highly inappropriate word ignorant.
Yeah.
Ignorant because we don't know certain ideas or words. And I feel like that is something that a lot of us lose and we, as we age, and it's being substituted with intelligence and the intelligence to make more long-term choices or making long-term plans, which isn't a bad thing. You know, it's not a bad thing being able to put words to certain things or ideas.
True.
The problem is when you stop testing out the ideas. The problem is when the idea becomes an ideology and you don't put theories to the test, because ultimately all these words and concepts, if we don't put them to the test, if we don't allow them to have a practical application or utility, then we can quickly end up feeling, we can quickly end up outsourcing our motivation to these words. We go like, I am competent, I am confident because I know these words and because I know these concepts.
Mm-hmm.
But are you then confident? Are you then competent? Or have you simply outsourced your competency and your confidence to those concepts?
Yeah, that's a great question. which can, I think, be seen in the amount of people who run courses after courses or go through courses after courses, get qualified in many, many different things and still don't have yet the courage to go out there and start teaching or coaching. Mm-hmm. Where you're now, you know, asking for others to tell you you're worthy, but you're still not yet willing. And I understand, we both can understand why, but you're not yet willing to put yourself out there and actually have that knowledge be tested out in real terms with other human beings and to see whether you can contextualize the theory that you seem to be very good with into the real world, i.e. on other human beings' bodies. Interesting. That's something actually I read again on your blog, and I mentioned to you before we started recording, I was just like, I am agreeing with everything this guy is writing. We're not going to have much to talk about then, because I think someone was asking you in a Q&A about, you know, how do I know when I'm ready to go out there and teach? And your answer was, you know, the one thing you got to do in order to become a teacher or a coach is to go out there and teach and coach. And I found myself talking about the same concept when we talk about parenting. So I'm not ready to be a parent yet. Well, trust me, you know, I've got a few and I don't feel I'm ready to be a parent yet, but you only become something by being that something.
Yeah. I'm not a parent myself. I do have cats. but yeah, I don't know why I said that. That doesn't relate to parenting at all, but basically the only personal responsibility I have outside of myself. Yeah. But one, I can't remember where I heard this, but somebody way more experienced in parenting than me said, children don't first and foremost need parenting. They need parents.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with coaching. Mm-hmm. Clients don't need coaching. They need coaches. And you need to get out there so that you can help define what that word means. You could help define that word coaching, mm-hmm. The verb. To the world, you can help it define it to your culture, or you can help define it for yourself. But ultimately, you need to first and foremost be a coach.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that definition will come, evolve, and change the more you do it.
Yes. Yes. That's the cool thing about definitions. They are not defined.
And that a beautiful paradox, which I think to be fair, I think this is the biggest issue with most of us. When we want to become something, we have an idea as to what it means even before we actually become that thing. And once you become it, you're like, okay, the goalposts have changed slightly. The definition that I really, really was living by is really slightly off. There's a dose of humility that comes with that. Interesting, isn't it? Wow.
Yeah.
No. If I was to say you don't have to love something to benefit from it, another thing that I picked up from your blog, and I'm really delving into your brain and your thoughts here and picking at a couple of things that really resonate with me. You don't have to love something to benefit from it. A lot of us, I believe, both in our practice and in our teaching, but especially nowadays in our relationships with others, and especially when it comes to, I put it this way. I remember being interested in studying yoga, shadow yoga in particular, with a teacher. And a couple of people have commented to me that person was not very nice. And I remember saying to myself and then responded to them by saying, well, I don't really need to like them in order to learn from them. And the person at the time said to me, well, then it's not yoga anymore, or then you're not really a student, you're a disciple. And the conversation went on about that. And it's funny, I'm talking, that was 12 years ago. I did not have yet my mind wrapped up around the concept, the idea, the understanding that you don't have to love something or someone to learn from them. But I already had that inkling, if that makes sense, of, you know what, the positive, as in I'm liking this experience, does not have to be there all the time for you to really learn great thing from either a relationship. And I'm talking obviously coachee, trainee, or teacher, trainer, or even a love, perhaps intimate relationship. And it's simply, whilst it can be a requirement, it is not the most pressing requirement for me to actually like a person or like the experience itself. Are you still pushing yourself through situations where you're not really liking the experience per se, but you're sticking with it because you can appreciate that you're just a bot, or you are learning, in the process of learning, something important?
I try to. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an everlasting challenge, you know, to challenge oneself.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to, because, I mean, I see it just as a good thing to be able to learn from more things. You know, the more things that you can potentially learn from, and the more things that you can interact with, well, the more experience you're going to get, the more you might learn, which in turn might make your life richer, or you might be able to help more people, or you might be able to expand your comfort zone as mm-hmm. well. So, yeah, I think I do try to continue to challenge myself and to let go of control, especially the control of having to enjoy absolutely everything to benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is also something that I try to encourage. I think everything can be a lesson.
True.
Ultimately, it's up to the individual to choose what they learn from.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have to acknowledge that there are a lot of things to learn from.
True. Very, very well said. Very, very well said. Super. I'm curious about your past. I've read and heard you speak very briefly about the fact that obviously you gave us your name, and with a surname such as Wen, spelled Y-U-E-N. I know that your dad is it from Shanghai?
He's from a small island group off the coast of mainland China, but it's not too far from Shanghai.
Okay.
It's not too far. Yeah.
Awesome. I had a conversation with a very good friend of mine, someone who, you know, is a big brother to me. He used to be my teacher also, called Jonathan, who, you know, I call John. And Jonathan used to be a professional singer. And something tells me that you have a past in music.
Yeah,
am I correct?
It was actually music that got me into movement, more or less. My dad was Chinese, or he is Chinese. And yeah. My mom is from Norway, and my mom, she always encouraged us to explore and play around with music and study it as well.
Mm-hmm.
She was a pianist, and she would let me try out almost any kind of instrument that I wanted to try out with any kind of teacher. And I was so lucky, because the house was filled with music all the time. Mm-hmm. All my siblings played instruments. And one thing that really appealed to me was singing. So I sang in different, you know, church choirs, which ultimately led to me working at the Norwegian Opera.
Mm-hmm.
Was my first ever job. And yeah, I spent a fair bit of time working in the opera. And at one point, this ballet teacher, he'd been watching me as I was doing this performance, and he just said, "You should really dance." And then I said, "Cool. How are we going to go about doing that?" And he said, "Oh, no worries. I'll teach you." And so he mentored me, and that was when I really became in love, or fell in love with movement.
Mm-hmm. Wow. How long was your ballet mentoring training for?
Not very long. It was maybe bit over half a year. The thing is, like, this guy, Fred Conrad is his name. This guy, he had such a tremendous amount of trust and faith in me. You know, he was like, you know, I'm going to train you every single day. It's just going to be me and you, and we're going to put on some music, and I'm going to teach you some basic classical ballet moves. Wow. And I was like, wow, I don't think I've had anyone believe in me this much. So I told him, my promise to you is that because you believe so much in me, I'm going to believe more in myself, and I'm going to become a professional dancer within like 2 years. Wow. So I trained with him for about 6 months, and then I basically dropped out of school, and then I just danced as much as I could.
How old were you then?
About 18, I think. Yeah.
Did you make it as a did you become a professional dancer?
Yeah. I danced with him for 6 months, and then I started doing some other like night classes, and then mm-hmm. I enrolled at this musical theater kind of school, mm-hmm. and I went there for about a year, and then I got my first job, and then I worked for a couple of years after that.
Interesting. And I say interesting because I'm sure you and I both know that becoming a dancer is not easy, not an easy feat whatsoever. And that actually, when you say 18, 19, 20, that's fairly old. I mean, some dancers become dancers much older than that, but they are a rarity. And for someone who hasn't been dancing since the age of 4, 5, 6, especially if you start with classical ballet, is a very, very interesting journey, to say the least. You must have really stretched yourself out. As in, what was the practice like, the commitment to the physical torture like for you?
It was a fairly stereotypical early 1990s film. I would, to afford dance classes, I would spend the evenings cleaning dance studios mm-hmm. and practice dancing as I was cleaning the studio. I would train maybe 6, 7, 8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And then I also, or I would practice 6, 7, 8 hours a day. And then I also had my own personal strength and conditioning training, which I did on the side. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there was a lot of work. I had a lot of people who supported me. You know, I had the dance teacher who owned the dance studio. She gave me a job, you know, cleaning the studio so that I could dance there. Yeah. When I started going to this musical theater school, I got the keys to the school so I could stay late and practice. Mm-hmm. No man is an island. I had mm-hmm. tons of people who supported me, and mm-hmm. and I really liked what I was doing. I liked that struggle. It was a battle worth fighting. I don't know.
Yeah. I hear you. I feel you. Well, I want us to be at some point soon talking about your coaching and how you became a coach and what you're doing also now. But I want us to stay a little bit on that, if that's okay with you, in a sense that what you just mentioned very passively and very humbly, if I may add, is very interesting, because from the age of 18 to 20, you basically practiced dance 6, 7, 8 hours. But in my experience, people who are able to do that come with a certain type of background in terms of their understanding of their learning strategy, their ability to focus and concentrate on tasks at length, their ability to deal with boredom. Can we go back to before 18? And where did you get this capacity to put yourself down on something? Okay, I understand your teacher, your mentor believed in you, but I don't believe this was enough for you to go, let me just dance for 8 hours a day, just like that. Did you have another set of trainings before that somehow taught you that discipline and regularity and consistency was important?
I think my my musical training, played a big role. I mean, I also did strength and conditioning before then, so I knew what pain and discomfort was, and these weren't, you know, they weren't foreign or scary concepts to me. That's one thing, but but playing an instrument, acquiring that skill, and also dealing with something as nebulous and abstract as musicality really helped me understand the concept of practicing more and being immersed in an experience. Like, you can't play music without being absorbed by it. So, you know, when you play an instrument, you kind of understand how to practice. You know that there's no reason for you to play an instrument and practice an instrument until your fingers begin to bleed, because then you can't practice the next day. And you know that you need to make the piece that you're playing your own. You know that there's a rhythm to things, there's a cadence, there's a dynamic, there's a mood, there's a genre, there's a story behind it. And you need to deal with the entire story behind the musical piece or just the scale that you're playing. That's what I believe, at least. That's how, what makes me feel like I am immersed in the music. And then I kind of just took that and I placed it on dance. 'Cause, I mean, again, you can, we romanticize dancers who, whose feet bleed because their point shoes have been on for too long. But yeah, it does. Like, if you bleed, if you injure yourself, you're not going to be able to practice the next day. So it's kind of, it's not that, it's not going to be a helpful, it's a cool story, but not a helpful practice. So the word discipline, I don't really feel disciplined. I feel immersed. I feel happy. I feel interested. I feel ambitious. But I'm not going to put myself through suffering if it's not going to help me, you know?
No, thank you for this. And quite literally, 2 weeks ago, I've published this conversation with my friend John, who I think I see a lot of similarities between the two of you. And he talked exactly about that. To him, good practice is digestible. Very digestible. And that's something that he's walked out over the years. He's older than us. He's getting closer to 50 now, but he's been at it for a long time. And having a yoga practice, a daily yoga practice of 3 to 5 hours for the last 34 years, really knows about practice with a capital P. And one of his key theme is always, you know, your practice has got to be pushing and enabling you to just achieve other things, but it cannot be at the cost of your practice. You know, and that's something that requires quite a bit of experience. We got to get it wrong before we get it right, but it's easy and useful when we hear people like yourself, coaches, mentors, actually mentioning this to the slightly younger-ish crowd of going, Blood is a cool story. I don't know if you've seen the movie Whiplash.
I have.
Yeah, a friend of mine watched it last week. Exactly. You know what I'm going with that, right? Yeah. It makes for a cool movie. It makes for a cool story to have your hands bleeding. But how the hell are you going to, not only it's not how musicians go about being so freaking, obsessed that they rag their bodies, but how are you going to go about playing the following day or the following week?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a good idea to romanticize abuse either, both abuse from others and self-abuse. But yeah, I freaking love the movie. It's
so did I.
An awesome movie. But at the same time, at the end of the movie, I sit there and I go, I hope people understand that and I hope I understand that this is a movie. This is entertainment. You can be inspired by it. You can love it. You can be motivated by it. But don't believe for a second that it's real.
Yeah. And that's what it takes to become, anything. And it's true. I remember having that little fear when the first time, well, I only watched it once. When the movie finished, I was like, this was entertaining. And I was a bass player. I've got my degree in music as well. And I came to the UK to become a professional musician. So I have a certain understanding of how, as you said, the patience that it takes, the groove that it gives you to somehow be working on two bars for 5 days, in order to get that one line, which within the context of a song, stretch that to a concert is actually nothing, but you just spend 5 days on literally 3.5 seconds. So I love that. And I love the romanticism of it as well, that love hate relationship. But finishing this movie, I was like, I hope nobody thinks, because I love the drums as well, I hope nobody thinks that to become a drummer, you have to go through this. Or to become a professional a musician, you have to go through this. Or that jazz musician go through this. You know, this is not real life. It is a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. it's so important to focus on. It's a part of human nature to imagine that great gifts come at great costs.
Yeah. True.
You know, like, and this, hey, the same applies to me in terms of, my own physicality. I like to imagine that the reason I have the capacity and the capabilities that I have is due to great sacrifice and pain. But no, a lot of the things that I do have been given to me by others, the inspiration and the belief and the motivation I get from them, from my environment, you know, growing up next to the woods and also getting to investigate two cultures, being half and half, and my genetics as well. You know, some things are simply given. And I think, although it is tempting to say this is due to my personal sacrifice, I think the greatest thing we can do for these gifts and for others is to be honest about where they're from.
And honor them. Yeah. Yeah, I know. I feel you. For, I'm mixed as well. My dad is from Guinea, West Africa, and my mom from the Ukraine, although I grown up in France. And I have this type of genetics where whatever sport I do, within 3 to 6 months, my body takes its shape. If I swim, I look like a swimmer within 3 months. But if I box, I look somehow like a boxer as well. And this is great. But obviously, you can imagine that my body is quite messed up also because the compensation patterns are so freaking strong that my spine bends and goes into all types of shapes. And interestingly enough, it's actually the bass playing that's destroyed me, so to speak, the most. Being bent up on the side like this for hours on end, wanting to look cool on stage with my head forward because, you know, it looks cool. And now my head is like this all the time. So having great genetics is something, as in great. Having genetics that help you, if you're lucky enough to somehow understand the concept behind them and have someone also guide you towards, okay, understanding that this is what you really need to be careful with. I went to see a physio that was recommended to me by a friend of mine who used to dance with the Royal Ballet. So she used to see a lot of ballet. She used to basically specialize in professional, but also younger ballet dancers. And we went into this conversation one day during our sessions where I had all the needles in and she had hooked me up to this machine, giving me electricity and what have you. Awesome. But she was explaining to me how a lot of the consultancy work that she was doing in ballet school was to talk to them about the diversity aspect and how genetics were could play a very important part as to the amount of strength and conditioning one should or could do, the amount of flexibility and the way hips were shaped and the way this and that. And she said to me, you know, it's difficult to talk about those things because especially nowadays where the concept of race is something that you cannot really speak about. That when you say, look, you see those black dancers over there with those fibers in those muscles and why their muscles are so bulky, and even though they're only 15, it's not the same thing as the guy over there. Or you see the Chinese ballet dancer over there who's got her oversplit without even warming up. There is something to do with her pelvis. We got to address that in her training, in her practice, in the way she's talked, but also how she assessed her own physical capabilities and how she maintained some type of health. So let us talk about strength and conditioning in relation to genetics, can we?
Sure.
Unless you've got something else you'd love to say before we go into that.
No, let's jump right into it.
Cool. It took me a while I think I knew that there was a difference between male and female in terms of, you know, ability to attain certain type of speed and strength and all those things and the various differences. But then I started to also, as a teacher, I remember 10 years ago, started to work with sprinters and sprinters of high levels, and mainly black women who were sprinters. And I could now started to see patterns where those guys, those ladies were not related, yet they carried the same compensation patterns. They carried the same way of moving about, and they carried also the same pains and aches. Now I'm now making the link between sports, the ethnical origins of someone, and one's ability to somehow deal with them. What's your experience like working with people of diverse backgrounds as a coach? Do you look now for the common threads, or do you go straight for the differences first? And if it's not a good question, feel free to rephrase it for us.
I just need to think a bit about it. I think we're humans, so we're pattern recognizing machines. You know, we're going to find commonalities, and we're going to find patterns if we look for them. That doesn't mean that those patterns don't exist, but my fear is that we overestimate the amount of recurring patterns because of our that's the way we make sense out of the world.
Sure.
So I try not to look for too many patterns. I try instead to focus on the limitations of my own perception of what I'm able to pick up, and try to remind myself to let the individual's experience be front and center. I do agree that, you know, there are physiological aspects that we need to address and that we need to take into consideration. I mean, that's kind of the job. But at the same time, nobody experiences their bodies better than the individual. And we need to remember that, okay, you have this body type, but there is something more specific than this body type that relates to you, which is you. So yeah, in terms of common denominators and differences, I believe that the common denominators are that we keep on addressing basics. And by basics, I mean basic concepts like not only how you move, but how much you move, the intensity of your movement, how your recovery is, your diet quality, your sleep, your stress, your perspective, your belief. These are basics that I try to teach the individual, that I try to learn more about, and that I try to keep fairly open so that there's enough room for the individual to move within it. And then by having the student or the client focus on that, they also help me more with designing a program or a process that is more appropriate for them as individuals and for them at that specific point in their lives or that specific week or that specific month. So I try not to focus too much on patterns.
Mm.
I feel like the patterns that I do recognize, they are more given to me than what I, you know, they kind of come automatically. And then I have to go through this process of figuring out, is this a pattern out there or is this a pattern in me?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because the only pattern that you can control is the one that is inside of you. And we all have these thoughts pattern where we go like, okay, I've seen this person and this person and this person do this or say this or experience this. Is there a common thread?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, before we address the common thread outside, let's address the common thread inside. Let's address our biases, our natural inclinations.
Yeah. No, thank you. Beautiful. Strength and conditioning, you mentioned that you've been working with your own program even before you became a dancer. How did you come to actual coaching or being coached? What was your how did you jump into this discipline?
By necessity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good old I need it.
Yeah, yeah. Again, it brings us back to that quote you mentioned at the beginning, you know, the necessity of limitations.
Yeah.
So I worked as a dancer for quite some time, but then I got to the point where that was no longer a valid, path for me because I had stage fright. I had anxiety. I didn't like being on stage anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't. I don't know what came first, like or couldn't. I don't think I'll ever find out.
Yeah, it's a good question to ask.
But I had to take a break and I needed some distance from my current situation so that then I moved to Hong Kong and I basically used up all my savings over there just to be there. Not to splurge or anything, just to live there and just, survive. And then when I got back to Norway, then I did one more job and then I got one more job offer. And then I signed the contract. And just the week after, I went back to the producer and I said, can we tear up this contract? And this producer, who became a very dear friend of mine, lovely man. He tore it up in front of me. He said, this is not for you and that's perfectly okay. So in order to earn money, make a living, I thought to myself, well, what can I do now that I have dropped out of school and I can no longer earn a living from moving my body and time with music, whatever can I do? And then I thought to myself, well, what have we always done? You've always moved. So I got a certification at the Academy for Personal Training here in Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And I was absorbed by the topic. I loved it. It was so fascinating to me. And there, I was so fascinated by how many things didn't make sense either. Like,
mm-hmm.
why do we say this? Why do we do this? Why is the culture, or why is the idea of training limited to gym culture? There's a lot of cultural baggage here. And there's a lot of words that and concepts that don't make a lot of sense. And so I went through the certification. And the same gym where we had the certification, I just asked for a job there and I got a job. I asked the teacher as I was a student, hey, what can I do to become a teacher? Because obviously you guys are at the top of your game. I want to be that too. So what do I need to do to get your job? And luckily somebody told me and I got the job as a teacher at the school.
Mm.
And that was basically it. From then, that point on, my life has been all about coaching and teaching and training, and necessity turned out to be a very, very big gift.
And that's something, you know.
Yeah.
And that a bitch. Yeah.
What about you? I mean, you mentioned that you moved to the UK to study music. Study music?
Yeah, I did. And during my second year of university, my back went and I couldn't play. So talk about necessity, consultations. Yeah. For 9 months, no one could tell me exactly what was going on. Anytime I would play, I would get burning sensations right here. Mm. It was obviously in relation to what you said earlier on when you have threads and patterns. There was also a story about this person. I was just about to become a dad. You know, there was a lot of stress and different things happening in my life. But in relation to the pain itself, anytime I would play, well, let me back it up just to tell you, to give you a little context. I used to smoke weed on a regular basis. And what happened was that when my wife got pregnant, when my son was now 16, going to be 17 soon, I decided to stop smoking weed. And because I don't really have an addictive personality, something I could always stop when I wanted to for long periods of time. So I decided to stop and to not only stop smoking, but also start to practice my bass guitar for 3 to 4 hours a day. Mm. Really knuckled down. Now, when you've been on a medicine for 10, 12 years, mm-hmm. your body has learned to hide quite a few things from you. Mm. And, you know, you've learned to deal with things, whether it's pain, sensations, and all those things in a certain way. And then when you cut yourself up from that, you know, shit, it's the fan. A lot of things come your way. So that's basically what happened. And I remember going to my doctor and, you know, RSI or carpal tunnel syndrome. We were talking about this. But none of what I was really doing was helping. And so I ended up seeing specialists, you know, people who work with musicians, and wrist specialist and tendon specialist and osteopath and chiropractors. And a chiropractor put me on to, he gave me a burnt, back in the days for people who are very young, you could burn DVDs. And he gave me a Pilates just to work on my posture. So that was when really and truly I started to move into the yoga, Pilates, somatic world, so to speak, through me not being able to play. And slowly but surely I started my yoga practice as well. And to come back to the story about the 9 months where I couldn't play, it's also the only goal that I had in my life, which was to be on tour, to be on stage, to be on various planes, to be recording albums. That was it. So now I'm becoming a dad. My wife already had a child, so I'm becoming a dad of two with a family, and I don't have my art form with which I normally express myself, with which I plan on making a living. Life was shitty, to say the least, as you can imagine. So that was the necessity of me having to really dig a little deeper and go, what can I do? Where can I go? What's next for me? I'm obviously not going to be a musician, or I didn't think it'd be possible for me to ever play to the level that I wanted to play again because of the amount of practice I needed to put in. And anytime I put the bass on my neck, or I would even sit to practice, within 5 minutes, I'd be a shooting pain up my spine and everything was painful. But one day something happened. I decided to pick up another instrument, play a bit of double bass, the flute and everything else. And the pain started to appear on the other side, which makes no sense because I'm a bass player. This is my fretting hand. And as you know, my body doesn't, you know what I mean? If it's in relation to the actual practice of playing the bass guitar, it shouldn't be appearing on the other side. And I remember going back to the very first doctor I went to, my local doctor, who, after having seen many specialists, and I've been spending quite a bit of money on them and time and you name it. He went like this. Oh, you've got a pinched nerve around C5, C6. I said, what? I said, yeah, it's in relation to your neck. Nothing to do with the actual structure or my body itself per se. So that was the what I needed to hear in order to really have an area of focus to say, okay, what do I need? Do I need to get stronger? Do I, you know, because in that time also I picked back up martial arts. I went back into Taekwondo. What is it that I need to do in order to somehow find myself again? And it was a case of, you know, sensory awareness, kinesthetic awareness, kinetic intelligence. How do I use my body? Because obviously I wasn't using it well. How do I hold myself? How mindful am I of my breathing? How do I cope with stress? Because now I'm not smoking anymore. This has got to be traveling somewhere. And so that led me into not only massage studies, but also yoga and Pilates. And within 6 months of practicing, I went for a teacher training course and became a teacher, and you know, the rest is history, so to speak. Eventually, music had to just go on the side because I couldn't commit to, you know, the gigs and the various sessions and everything else. I did that for a couple of years, mixing both. Eventually, yoga paid much more than playing funk, reggae, and dub. There was a regular aspect to me teaching that I've decided to simply focus on the teaching aspect, because teaching is what I like to do. So yeah, that's the story of my way into, I wouldn't say movement, because I was a dancer before, as in a street dancer. I was never taught. But that's how I went back into working with the body, so to speak, by being forced to. I just didn't have a choice.
Yeah. Man, what a ride.
Yeah. Tell me about it. Yeah.
But it's something that I hope that very few people have to go through. A lot do, if we're going to be honest.
Unfortunately, yeah, true. Yeah.
But what a way, you know, to learn about the importance of feeling comfortable in your body.
Yeah.
What a necessary lesson. And man, sometimes the sooner you learn it, the better. Because then you start dealing with it and start getting involved in it sooner.
Yeah, this is that. It's getting involved with it as opposed to just be a passive passenger for, you know, what is supposed to be your life story.
Yeah. So
when it comes to movement.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's, you know, one of the greatest benefits of being a human being is the opportunity to learn from other people's mistakes. But the biggest curse is the fact that we never do. We have to learn from ourselves. You know, sure. We have to go through these sometimes life-changing situations.
Yeah. And you said it early on, you can be taught a few things, but there are quite a few things you can only learn by yourself.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing something you said, but you know, along those lines, and that's very, very true. Very true. So tell us about now, because I know you're working on some very amazing projects online. I've been watching you from afar in terms of, I know you're setting up a cult.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yes.
A movement cult. So people wanting to become disciples, this is your guru.
Come drink the Kool-Aid.
Let's talk about the Movement Guild.
So yeah, the Movement Guild is, I guess, one of the less cultier things that I do, but it's still fun. It's an online coaching community and course, the three C's. So I started the Movement Guild a year back or so, and it's always been on my mind to create a course where we address basics. So basically we go through four phases, and in each phase we address a basic principle. So the first phase, we go through volume. How much do you do? And then all the lessons that you can find on like an online course player are about volume. What are the general recommendations? How do we navigate these recommendations? What is it? How do we deal with it? And then we give our students or members, we give them a program. And in the program, because the main subject is volume, they are in charge of volume.
Mm-hmm.
So everything else in the program is more or less set. Like they have options, but it's more rigid. But the flexibility that they have to deal with is volume. The next phase, we deal with auto-regulation and how to auto-regulate movements based on how you're feeling on a given day. So in that program, the flexibility that they have to deal with is auto-regulating, which exercises to do. And the next phase is skill acquisition and prioritization. The next skill, next phase is movement quality and creativity. So what we're trying to encourage is autonomy. And what we're trying to make people focus on or being more aware of is how complex the basics are, because basics are by necessity general. They are wide and open subjects, which means that we need to make you competent. We need to make you confident. Again, those two words, so that you feel confident enough to create your own theory and then mm-hmm. put that theory to the test. Yeah. And by going through that that experiment, you'll gain competence. Yeah. And if the end result, or no, if the byproduct is that you get stronger, more flexible, or you improve your coordination or something like that, then great. But that's mm-hmm. not the main point. The main point is autonomy, basics, confidence, competence. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of fun. So I run this with my dear friend Jeremy Fine, who is, I cannot speak highly enough of this man. He is such an elegant teacher and a master juggler and coach in general. We'll be doing more units now where we're going to focus on other basics and work with other teachers.
Awesome. So
it's I love it. It's really rewarding.
Beautiful. Wow. You've been running that for a year. And may I ask, if it's not a private information, how many people do you have in this community?
Right now in this current season, we have 150 people. One thing though is that we have this saying, which is once a guildling, which is what we call our members, once a guildling, always a guildling. So if you've been a member, then you're a part of the community. And when you're a part of the community, you get to join live classes, for example, for free.
Mm.
So our total number would be, I guess, closer to 450, I think.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. The best way to get onto this, to join the cult, is it through the John, your personal website, or do you have a specific website for the guild?
We don't have a specific website because we're going through a rebranding process right now. But anything that I do, you can find on my website, unjohn.com.
Cool. That will be, the link will be in the show notes, guys, listening and watching. So just click below. Super. What else besides the guild are you working on or with? I know that, and let me be a bit more precise and specific in my question. This is in relation to you serving others and as such serving yourself, because you obviously say you're having such a good time doing so. But what are you doing for yourself?
For myself.
Selfishly.
Selfishly, I know it's important, right now. Right?
Yeah.
The thing that I do mostly for myself is my own training.
Mm-hmm.
So like I haven't posted on Instagram for ages just because, and I don't post my own training, or I haven't for a long time because I just wanted to do it for myself. Yeah. You know, I wanted to just make it as personal and as fun and laid back and interesting as possible.
Mm.
So that's one thing. Another thing is just spending a lot of time reading, spending a lot of time with my animals, spending a lot of time in nature, like out in the woods. I like that a lot. But I'm lucky enough to get to work with people that let me feel like my professional life is an extension and somewhat an intrusion on my personal life.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I run this other project called Movement Quest, which is all about, like, it's a community for movers. People who are interested in movement and who don't want to take it too seriously.
Okay.
Like, they can take their training seriously. They can take their issues and their problems seriously. But we don't take movement as a culture seriously.
Yeah.
So this I do with my good friends, DJ Murakami and Jonathan Winmaster. And we basically just have fun. It's it's a community. It's like a cheap subscription to be a member. Inside of the community, we have, we basically just started, but we're going to have live calls. We're going to play games. We're going to have, we're going to release an exclusive podcast. And we also have this series, like this, if you know about the TV series The Office, we do that, but with a gym.
Okay.
Called Move Corp. Where we also invite like different known trainers in the movement culture to be guest stars, like they do cameo appearances.
Mm-hmm.
We play games. There are a lot of fun games. And we're also gonna, in the Movement Quest, in the Movement Guild, we focus on basics. In the Movement Quest, we focus on specifics. So we're going to have webinars that address very specific topics, and then we're going to have longer, what we call quests, because we don't want to call it a course or a program or a workshop. We just want to let the teacher do whatever they think is going to be the most exciting way to explore a specific subject. So various teachers will then take you on quests. Sometimes they're main quests. Sometimes there's side quests. And the goal is just to learn and have fun and don't take ourselves or movement too seriously.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Sounds amazing. All right.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Awesome. Wow, thank you for sharing. I'll check it out. And as I mentioned, all the links, I'll walk out all the links and put them below. I would like us to finish this conversation off with a couple of fire questions, rapid fire questions, which you are more than welcome to actually expand on, and you don't have to be very quick about it. And they tend to be, I like to call them personal questions, but they are not really, nothing to do with personal life, but you'll understand in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So, John, what is your favorite word?
Petrichor.
Okay, I like this. What's your favorite job?
Cook.
Mm-hmm. To cook.
Yeah.
I need to introduce you to the other John because it would say exactly the same thing. There's something. Tell me, what's your favorite skill?
Communication.
Mm. Mm. Now, can you tell us something you know for sure?
No.
I know that for sure. Can you tell us something you're not sure about?
That's my answer. Just silence.
That's a good one. And now a bit of a perhaps far, you know, out the box question, just to get you thinking even more. Can you think of something that you surprisingly, and I say that in relation to people who know you, perhaps your students, your coaches, people who work with you, your colleagues, would be surprised to know or to hear that you don't know anything about. So something that people who know you either very well or fairly well, would be surprised to hear that you know nothing about?
Oh, what a good question. Conditioning training. I know next to nothing about it.
Really?
Yeah. It's never crossed my mind to kind of learn more about it. But I try to, if a client has asked me about it, then I will mm-hmm. refer them to somebody else and I'll say, that's not my forte. But I guess it's, you know, as a trainer, people often expect you to know everything about everything related to the human body, which is crazy. A lot of things.
Yeah.
So I guess it would be cool to kind of, I mean, I really appreciate you asking the question because it's so healthy for the coaching culture and the training culture in general, for people to specify what they're not good at so that mm-hmm. you can end up collaborating with the other people.
Yeah.
So yeah, don't come to me for coaching advice on conditioning, or at least come to me and then expect to be referred to somebody who is way more proficient than I.
Yeah. And when you do refer them, people don't take it personally, basically. That's what John is saying.
Yeah. They do not. They do not.
Awesome. John, it's been such a pleasure chatting and talking with you. I really, really, really appreciated your time and wisdom. So thank you so much for being on the Talking, Teaching, and Flow podcast. It's been awesome.
Hey, likewise. Thank you for the conversation. This was a really enjoyable conversation.
I'm glad to hear. I hope you have learned something here and that you get to teach it. Go to rafan.co.uk to subscribe to my newsletter. And remember that when one teaches, two learn. So do teach and learn as much as you can.